Reading from Sports Illustrated, a one-hour reading of sports news. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin today's reading with a feature that's entitled, Brock Purdy's New Contract Comes with Expectations to Win. And this feature written by Nick Wagner of ESPN, Dateline, Santa Clara, California. In April of 2021, the San Francisco 49ers traded up to select quarterback Trey Lance, number 3 overall in the NFL draft. Lance was viewed as their future franchise signal caller for the years to come. The 49ers' goal was to have a quarterback on a rookie contract while using resources to build a dominant roster around the quarterback. The hope was that the pieces would equate to a Super Bowl championship. As it turned out, the Niners did benefit from a rookie quarterback contract window, but it was Brock Purdy, not Lance, who became the team's starter a year later in 2022 and was playing for the relatively meager wages associated with being the last pick, Mr. Irrelevant, in the 2022 draft. Purdy led the 49ers to 2 NFC championship games, including 1 win. But the team failed to win its 6th Lombardi Trophy in Super Bowl 58. We made him the last pick of the draft, and it has served us well, General Manager John Lynch said. Now, Purdy's rookie contract that paid him an average of $850,000 per season has ended, and he signed a 5-year, $265 million contract, which includes $181 million in guarantees that runs through the 2030 season. That makes Purdy the highest-paid player in franchise history, meaning San Francisco has reached the expiration date on the inexpensive quarterback plus expensive roster formula. Though Purdy's early contract cap numbers figure to remain manageable, the Niners, for better or worse, are now in Purdy's hands. The days of Purdy being praised as one of the best bargains in sports are done, and it is up to him to deliver at a level commensurate with being the 7th highest paid quarterback in the NFL on a per-year basis. Despite an avalanche of off-season roster changes after a 6-win, 11-loss season, there is no better time for Purdy to begin delivering on that than 2025. The 49ers will enter next season with the easiest schedule in the league, at least based on their opponents' results from 2024. If things go according to plan, Purdy should welcome back running back Christian McCaffrey, left tackle Trent Williams, and receiver Brandon Ayuk from injuries that cost them large portions of last season. George Kittle also remains one of the league's premier tight ends and just signed a 4-year contract extension that should ensure that he remains one of Purdy's favorite targets for the foreseeable future. Perhaps another appearance in the Super Bowl, which is set to be played at the 49ers' Levi Stadium, is asking too much given the team's many different off-season departures. But if Purdy can return closer to his 2023 form, it would offer reassurance that he is the franchise quarterback that the team has been seeking for more than two decades. Purdy must prove that he is, as 49ers owner Jed York called him at the league meetings in March, one of the 10 best quarterbacks in the league. That assertion can be backed up by the numbers, if not the eye test. Since taking over as the Niners starter in Week 13 of 2022, Purdy is fourth in QBR rating, third in passing yards, first in yards per attempt, and seventh in touchdown passes. "I think he's great," York said, "especially when you combine him with Kyle and you combine him with what we have, and he's a heck of a quarterback. And we want him to be here for a long, long time," unquote. Even before Purdy signed his new deal, the effects of the contract were being felt in San Francisco. The Niners went through a significant roster purge in the offseason, losing key free agents such as cornerback Charvarius Ward, linebacker Dre Greenlaw, safety Talonia Hufanga, and guard Aaron Banks. They also released starting defensive tackles Javon Hargrave and Maliak Collins, as well as end Leonard Floyd, and traded away wide receiver Deebo Samuel Sr. and running back Jordan Mason. The result of that exodus is nearly $81 million in dead salary cap money, easily the most in the NFL in 2025, and a roster that will rely heavily on 11 drafted rookies to fill the holes after the 49ers spent little in free agency. Neither York nor Lynch nor coach Kyle Shanahan shied away from the reality that much of their off-season focus was clearing the decks on the roster to make room for Purdy's deal. Teammates such as Kittle, linebacker Fred Warner, Williams, and McCaffrey have given Purdy repeated votes of confidence and voiced their approval of Purdy's eventual payday. The 49ers are betting big that not only can Purdy return to at or near the production that he provided in 2022 and 2023, but that he can also continue to grow as a player even if his supporting cast is diminished. Purdy's numbers fell off in 2024 when he was without McCaffrey, Ayuk, and Williams for much of the year and was also missing other key starters from time to time. During that trying season, Purdy continued to struggle in inclemente weather while his 1.7 touchdown-to-interception ratio ranked 23rd in the NFL. He also continued to struggle in authoring late-game comebacks. Despite those issues, Purdy finished with a 67.9 QBR, which ranked 7th in the NFL, and grew as a scrambler with a career-high 323 yards and 5 touchdowns. That production was more than enough for the 49ers to believe in Purdy. For all the talk of the team's belief in Purdy the past 3 years, the ultimate litmus test would occur during extension negotiations. You need to be certain on that, Shanahan said. If you pay a quarterback and if it's not who you are certain about, then it's not going to be very fun after that, unquote. The inherent implication in Purdy's new deal is that the onus falls on him to be the type of force multiplier who can raise the production of those around him and usher in a new era of 49ers football with him at the forefront. And again, that ESPN feature is entitled Brock Purdy and the 49ers agree to a 5-year, $265 million deal, written by Nick Wagner of ESPN. And from NFL news, let's turn now to some WNBA news. Headline reads, Caitlin Clark's triple-double leads the Indiana Fever past the Chicago Sky in opener. And this feature, written by Michael Vopel of ESPN, Dateline Indianapolis. The Fever started their season Saturday with a blowout victory over the Chicago Sky, a triple-double from Caitlin Clark, a career milestone for Indiana newcomer DeWanna Bonner, and a kerfuffle between Clark and Chicago's Angel Reese. Talk about a full opening day. Gainbridge Fieldhouse was packed with 17,274 fans to see the Fever defeat the Sky 93-58, tying for the second largest margin of victory in franchise history. Clark, last season's Rookie of the Year and an all-WNBA first-team selection, got her third triple-double in the league after 17 in college at Iowa. She had 20 points, 10 rebounds, and 20 assists, plus 4 blocks. Still, a lot of attention will go to a sequence in the third quarter. Clark, looking to stop Reese from getting a wide-open layup, tried to strip her of the ball and was called for a foul. Reese fell to the floor and then got up to go after Clark, who walked away. Indiana's Elia Boston, attempting to keep the two players apart, picked up a technical foul, which she didn't know about until after the game when asked about it by media. Boston, who finished with 19 points, 13 rebounds, and 5 blocks, then expressed astonishment about getting teed up. Clark told her, "I got it for you. Don't worry about the $200 fine." As for the original action, for which Clark's foul was upgraded to a flagrant one, Clark, she said, was making a play on the ball. "Let's not make it anything that it is not," Clark said. "I'm not sure what the refs saw to upgrade it. That's up to their discretion after watching the initial whatever happened during the play and whatever happened afterward. It's a take foul to put them at the free throw line rather than give up 2 points. That's exactly what it was. I wasn't trying to do anything malicious," unquote. Asked by a pool reporter after the game, crew chief Roy Golubin expressed the official's reasoning, quote, "The foul by Clark met the criteria for flagrant foul for wind-up, impact, and follow-through for the extension of the left hand to Reese's back, which is deemed not a legitimate basketball play and therefore deemed unnecessary contact. After the foul, there is the physical taunt technical on Boston and a verbal technical on Reese, which offset," unquote. In a brief Sky postgame news conference, Reese, who had 12 points and 17 rebounds, said of the foul, quote, "Basketball play. Refs got it right. Move on," unquote. Last season, Reese and then-Sky player Chenity Carter were called for flagrant fouls on plays against Clark in two different games. The foul against Carter was not upgraded until the next day, though. Both Clark and Reese have downplayed any personal rivalry between them, but their fan bases have been at odds since they met in the 2023 NCAA tournament final, in which Reese's LSU squad beat Clark's Hawkeyes. Clark was the number one pick in the 2024 draft. Reese was number seven. The Fever and the Sky will play five times during the regular season. Their next matchup is on June the 7th at the United Center in Chicago. Indiana's Stephanie White, starting her second stint coaching the Fever, said that she was happy with how well her team played defensively and the chemistry that it showed before and after the incident involving Reese and Clark. "Nobody's going to get anything easy against us. We're going to be a tough defensive team," White said. "I thought that it was a clear play on the ball as well. I am proud of this group. We have a lot of young players, and we have a lot of veterans. And understanding moments where we have opportunities to grow from a mental toughness standpoint and from an execution standpoint, I felt that that was a moment where we came together and we used that to propel us," unquote. One of the Fever's veterans is Bonner, who is new this season to Indiana, but is in her 18th year in the WNBA. Bonner scored 7 points Saturday and moved into third place all time in the league in scoring, behind retired standout Diana Taurasi and the Connecticut Sun's Dina Charles. Bonner and the Seattle Storm's Alicia Clark are the oldest active players in the WNBA at age 37. Bonner said that the atmosphere in the arena on Saturday and the embrace of the Fever fans made it special for her, along with her twin daughters being at the game. "Definitely a perfect opening day," said Bonner, who signed with Indiana as a free agent after previously playing with the Sun and the Phoenix Mercury, with whom she won WNBA championships with Taurasi in 2009 and 2014. Quote, "To play in front of that crowd, when I walked out, I was just like, oh my God. I think that I was a little shell-shocked. I am just honored. I always say that I play with the greatest of all time in Diana. I had the blueprint on how to stay in this league. She did it for 20 years, unquote. Clark is in just her second season, and fellow number one pick Boston is in her third. But the two have helped turn around the franchise. They combined with guard Kelsey Mitchell last year to get the Fever back in the playoffs for the first time since the 2016 season, which aided the team in hiring free agents Bonner and Natasha Howard, who had 15 points Saturday, along with Mitchell's 15. "This is a great first win, but we have 43 more games to go," Boston said. "So for us, it's just about making sure that we lock in, rewatch the game, look at what we need to work on," unquote. And again, that feature is entitled "Caitlin Clark's Triple-Double Leads the Fever Past the Sky in the Opener," written by Michael Vopel of ESPN. And from women's basketball news, let's turn to some horse racing news. Headline reads, "Journalism comes from behind to win the Preakness, Dateline Baltimore." Journalism won the 150th running of the Preakness Stakes on Saturday, coming from behind down the stretch to make good on the lofty expectations of being the favorite in the middle leg of the Triple Crown, 2 weeks after finishing second to Sovereignty in the Kentucky Derby. Finishing first in a field of 9 horses that did not include Sovereignty but featured some of the best competition in the country, journalism gave trainer Michael McCarthy his second Preakness victory. It is Umberto Rispoli's first in a Triple Crown race, and he's the first jockey from Italy to win one of them. Gosker was second, Sandman third, and Goal-Oriented fourth. Journalism thrived on a warm day that dried out the track after torrential rain fell at Pimlico Racecourse for much of the past week. Those conditions suited him better than the slop at Churchill Downs in the Derby. Sovereignty did not take part after his owners and trainer Bill Mott decided to skip the Preakness, citing the 2-week turnaround, and aim for the Belmont Stakes on June the 7th. That made this a 5th time in 7 years that the Preakness, for various reasons, was contested without a Triple Crown bid at stake. And again, that Associated Press release is headlined, "Journalism Comes from Behind to Win the Preakness." And from horse racing news, let's turn now to some golf news. The next headline reads, "Great Scotty, Scheffler rolls to first PGA Championship." And this feature, written by Doug Ferguson of the Associated Press, Dateline, Charlotte, North Carolina. Scotty Scheffler worked harder than he imagined and got the result everyone expected Sunday in the PGA Championship. A most pleasant walk to the 18th green and another major title secure in the hands of golf's number one player. Scheffler was flawless when he had to be on the back nine of Quail Hollow, leaving the blunders to John Rahm and everyone else trying to catch him on a final day that turned tense until Scheffler pulled away with a steady diet of fairways and greens. Quote, "This back nine will be one that I remember for a long time," Scheffler said. "It was a grind out there. I think at one point on the front nine, I maybe had a 4 or 5 shot lead, and making the turn, I think I was tied for the lead. So to step up when I needed to the most, I'll remember that for a while," unquote. He closed with a bogey that he could afford for an even par 71, giving him a 5-shot victory and his 3rd major title. Scheffler became the first player since Seve Ballesteros to win his first 3 majors by 3 shots or more. The margin doesn't match up with the grind. That much was clear when Scheffler raised his arms on the 18th green and then ferociously slammed his cap to the turf, a brand of emotion rarely seen by the 28-year-old Texas star. Scheffler was 5 shots ahead coming to the last hole when he won his first Masters green jacket back in 2022. He was 4 shots clear of the field when he won at Augusta National last year. And he had a 6-shot lead at Quail Hollow. But this sure didn't feel like a walk in the park. He had a 5-shot lead standing on the 6th tee, but with a shaky swing that led to 2 bogeys, and with John Rahm making 3 birdies in a 4-hole stretch around the turn, they were tied when Scheffler got to the 10th tee. It looked like a duel to the finish, with Bryson DeChambeau doing all he could to get into the mix. Under the most pressure he felt all day, Scheffler didn't miss a shot off the tee or from the fairway until his lead went back to 4 shots. John Rahm wound up 7 shots behind, but the 2-time major champion was the only serious threat. His chances, though, began to fade when he failed to birdie the 14th and 15th holes, the 2 easiest holes on the back 9 and the last good scoring chances. His 5-wood on the reachable par 4 14th was a yard from being perfect, instead going into the bunker. He blasted out weakly, and his 7-foot birdie putt never had a chance. He drilled a 345-yard drive on the par 5 15th, and his 4-iron went just over the back. Rahm putted it too hard, and it rolled 12 feet. He missed that birdie putt, and then came unglued. A bogey on the 16th hole went from rough to bunker. Having to take on a dangerous pin at the par 3 17th, it bounded over the sun-baked green into the water for double bogey. And his last tee shot went left off the grassy bank and into the stream for another double bogey. All that work to make up a 5-shot deficit at the start of the day, and Rahm closed with a 73 to tie for 8th. "Yeah, the last 3 holes, it was a tough pill to swallow," said Rahm, his first time seriously contending in a major since he left for the Saudi riches of LIV Golf Tour 2 years ago. "I'll get over it. I'll move on," Rahm said. "Again, there's a lot more positive than negative to think about this week. I'm really happy I put myself in position and hopefully learn from this and give it another go in the U.S. Open," unquote. DeChambeau birdied the 14th and 15th to get within 2 shots, but he never had another good look at birdie and bogeyed the 18th for a 70. He tied for second with Harris English and Davis Riley, who overcame a triple bogey on hole number 7 to play bogey-free the rest of the way and salvaged a 72. Quote, "I am baffled right now. Just felt like things just didn't go my way this week," DeChambeau said. "I drove it as good as I can. I gave myself a good chance. I just felt like a couple breaks went a different way," unquote. J.T. Poston, the North Carolina native who also flirted with an outside chance, bogeyed the last 2 holes for a 73 to tie for 5th. English finished his Sunday best score as Scheffler was making his way down the 3rd hole. He had a flight to catch that afternoon. He also was the clubhouse leader. But he looked at Scheffler's name atop the leaderboard and said with a smile, quote, "I don't see him slipping a whole lot. I see myself catching my flight," unquote. But then Scheffler was unable to find his swing. He hit only 2 fairway shots on the front 9. He failed to convert birdies on the par 5 7th and the reachable par 4 8th. On 8 of his 9 holes, his miss was to the left, and he was tied with the red-hot John Rahm. But part of Scheffler's greatness is his ability to wear down a field, which he did at the Masters both times he won. "I hit the important shots well this week, and that's why I'm walking away with the trophy," Scheffler said. He finished at 11 under par at a 273 and picked up his 15th victory in just his 6th year on the PGA Tour. Dating to the year 1950, Scheffler is the 3rd fastest player to go from 1 to 15 tour wins, behind only Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus, and even then by a matter of months. His victory comes a month after Rory McIlroy captured the Masters to complete the career Grand Slam. The PGA Championship was always going to be a tough act to follow, and it didn't come close in terms of drama. But it served as a reminder why Scheffler has been number one for two straight years, and why it will take a lot to replace him. Rory McIlroy made the cut on the number, shot 72 and 72 over the weekend, and tied for 47th. It was his lowest 72-hole finish in 4 years in the majors. McIlroy declined all 4 days to speak to the media. Scheffler came into the PGA Championship off an 8-shot victory in the CJ Cup Byron Nelson, and then he won a major by 5. It was the first time since Woods in the year 2000 that a player won consecutive PGA Tour starts by 5 shots or more in the same season. And again, that Associated Press feature is entitled Great Scotty, Scheffler Rolls to First PGA Championship, written by Doug Ferguson of the Associated Press. And from golf news, let's turn now to some tennis news. The next feature is headlined Alcaraz bolsters status as French Open favorite, wins the Italian title. This feature, written by Andrew Domf of the Associated Press, Dateline Rome. There's only one player who is consistently beating Yannick Sinner. Carlos Alcaraz defeated the top-ranked Sinner again, 7-6, 6-1, to win his first Italian Open on Sunday and add another big clay court title to his resume. Since the start of last year, Alcaraz is the only player to beat Sinner more than once, and now he's done it 4 straight times. Just proud about myself, the way that I approached the match mentally. Tactically, I think I did it pretty well from the first to the last point, Alcaraz said. I maintained my level during the whole match, unquote. Alcaraz's victory before Sinner's home fans at the Foro Italico snapped the Italian's 26-match winning streak, which stretched back to last October when Alcaraz beat him in the China Open final in a third-set tiebreaker. Alcaraz now leads the career series 7-4. It was Sinner's first tournament back after a 3-month doping ban. I'm just really happy to see Yannick back at this amazing level, Alcaraz said. I'm sure it wasn't easy for him coming back from 3 months without playing. Making the final here is something insane, unquote. Alcaraz also solidified his status as the favorite to defend his title at the French Open, which starts next Sunday. On clay right now, you're the best player, Sinner said. Added Alcaraz, beating Yannick, winning Rome. I think that both things mixed together give you a great confidence coming to Paris. I always say that the final is not about playing, the final is about winning, to go for it. I just repeated that to myself all the time, unquote. Sinner was playing his first tournament since he won his third Grand Slam title at the Australian Open in January. In February, Sinner agreed to a settlement with the World Anti-Doping Agency that raised questions since the 3-month suspension allowed him not to miss any Grand Slams and come back at his home tournament. Sinner said that he and his team went through 3 months that were anything but easy, so achieving this result already here is really big, and we should really be proud, unquote. He added, "We're bringing home a very special trophy, even if I wanted the other one," unquote. Sinner was attempting to become the first home man to win the Italian Open since Adriano Panatta in 1976. He was also trying to complete a sweep of the Rome singles titles for Italy after Jasmine Paolini won the women's trophy on Saturday. Paolini and partner Sarah Arani also defended their women's doubles title earlier on Sunday, making Paolini the first woman since Monica Seles in 1990 to sweep Rome's singles and doubles titles in the same year. A large number of the 10,500 fans in Campo Centrale were decked out in orange, Sinner's theme color, and they were chanting Sinner's name before the match even began, and even after Sinner lost. Quote, "You gave me a lot of energy, a lot of courage to be here on court. I tried with everything I had," Sinner told the crowd. "It was something very, very special. Thank you," unquote. Sinner also cracked a joke about offering special thanks to his brother Mark, who, instead of being here, decided to go to Imola to watch Formula One racing, unquote. Sinner wasted two set points on Alcaraz's serve when he led 6-5 in the first set, and then Alcaraz jumped ahead in the tiebreaker with two aces and held on to seal it before cruising in the second set. On Alcaraz's third match point, Sinner ran down a drop shot, but Alcaraz was waiting for his reply and hit a stretch volley winner into the open court. Alcaraz then held his hands out wide and flashed a wide smile. Alcaraz hit 19 winners to Sinner's 7 and only had one more unforced error than his opponent. Half of Sinner's errors came from his backhand, which is usually his most dependable shot. Alcaraz, a four-time Grand Slam champion, will move back up to number 2 in the rankings after his third final in 3 clay court events this season. He won the Monte Carlo Masters and finished runner-up in the Barcelona Open before withdrawing from the Madrid Open because of injury. Having also won the Madrid Open in 2022 and 2023, Alcaraz became the fifth man to win all 3 Masters 1000 clay events after Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic, Gustavo Kuerten, and Marcelo Rios. And again, that feature entitled Alcaraz Bolsters Status as French Open Favorite, Wins the Italian Title, written by Andrew Domph of the Associated Press. The headline for the next feature reads, Oldest Living New York Met Looks Back at 70 Years in Baseball. And this feature, written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today, Dateline, Scottsdale, Arizona. John Wooden recruited him to play basketball at UCLA, while Branch Rickey wanted him to play baseball for the Brooklyn Dodgers. He was teammates with Hall of Famers Willie Mays, Roberto Clemente, Willie McCovey, Ernie Banks, and Larry Doby during his playing career. He managed Hall of Famers Billy Williams and Bruce Sutter. He worked for Charlie Finley, and he hung out with Sadaharu Oh. Welcome to the beautiful life of Jim Marshall. Jim Marshall is an original member of the infamous 1962 New York Mets and was honored on May the 5th as the oldest living Met before their night game against the Arizona Diamondbacks at Chase Field. Quote, "I worked in baseball for 70 years, said Marshall, who turns 94 years old later this month. And as a baseball player or manager, we always dream of being number one. Well, I finally made it, unquote. His greatest memory of that season, when the New York Mets went 40 wins, 120 losses, and produced the most losses until the Chicago White Sox toppled it last year. Quote, opening day at the Polo Grounds, Marshall says, they were doing the player introductions, and when they got to me, they booed the hell out of me because Gil Hodges wasn't playing. He was hurt, but they just buried me. Welcome to New York, unquote. Rufus James Marshall, who has gone by his middle name since attending Compton High School in California, spent 5 years in the major leagues as a first baseman and pinch hitter. He played 3 years in Japan for the Chunichi Dragons. He managed the Chicago Cubs for 3 years and Oakland Athletics for 1 year. He scouted nearly 25 years for the Arizona Diamondbacks. He spent 2 hours with USA Today Sports talking about his life, his fondest memories, and favorite funny moments from his 70-year pro baseball career. One of his memories is Casey Stengel's trouble with names. Quote, Casey was so bad with names, and when I was playing for the Mets, he kept calling me Blanchard. There was a Johnny Blanchard with the Yankees where he had managed before. He kept calling me Blanchard, so I just let him do it. One day I'm in the batter's box at the Polo Grounds, and here comes Casey out of the dugout. I step out, and he says to me, shoot for the lines, shoot for the lines. I say, what the hell does that mean? And he says, all of the players are in the middle of the field, so shoot for the lines. I guess it made sense. He didn't know the players' names, but I'll tell you one thing, he was magic with the press, unquote. Next, we look at the time that he saw his life flash before his eyes. Quote, I'm facing Bob Gibson. The batter ahead of me dug a pretty good hole in the batter's box, so I'm just filling in the hole, brushing dirt into it. Gibson sees me and says, make it nice and comfortable because that's where you're going to be laying, unquote. And I thought, holy smokes, I think he means it. And sure enough, he knocked me down on my butt. He went right at my head. That ball just missed me. If it hit me, I wouldn't be sitting here today, unquote. And Jim Marshall next reflects on the Ichiro family fandom, quote, when I was scouting the Pacific Rim, I saw Ichiro Suzuki a lot, and he told me that his dad was a huge Chunichi Dragons fan and actually has a picture of me in their house. Ichiro was such a great guy, great kid. He would always call me Gaijin, which means foreigner in Japanese. So the first time I see him when he gets to Seattle, I walk into their clubhouse and say, well, you're the Gaijin now. And he says, oh, grandfather, don't tease me. I remember how he wanted to come to America so bad, and he used to come and swing the bat right in front of me, and then we'd go have dinner together. He was my favorite player, my absolute favorite player. The dedication, the discipline, the speed, the arm. My God, he had it all. I knew Ichiro would be a great player, but not a Hall of Famer. He could run, he could play defense, and he could spray the ball. The crazy thing is, he could have been a great home run hitter if he wanted to, but chose to be a batting champion. That's how talented he was, unquote. In 1963, Marshall was the first American-born player to go from the major leagues to Japan. Quote, I was playing in Pittsburgh. The season is over. And Joe Brown, the general manager, calls me into his office. He says, you don't have a chance of making this team next year. We got two first basemen. If I were you, I'd go to Japan and make good money. I want you and your wife to fly over, see if you feel comfortable, and see if you want to do it. It changed my whole life. I love the people there. I made some good money and played every day. They had such a love for baseball, and nobody ever talked about the war. The only trouble was when we went to places like Osaka and Hiroshima, and the crowd chanted, "Go home, white monkey," in Japanese. But the players protected me, unquote. Marshall's favorite teammate was Piper Davis, his teammate with the Oakland Oaks in the Pacific Coast League. Quote, "I was in the Pacific Coast League, and Piper took me under his wing. We would go to each other's room and talk baseball almost every night, which was unusual back in the day. He would tell me so much about Willie Mays and how he helped develop him and protect him from outside influence. I love the man. What a special person." Unquote. Davis played for the Birmingham Black Barons and the Homestead Grays in the Negro Leagues, and later managed Birmingham. He was most famous for getting Willie Mays to play for the Black Barons in 1947 when Mays was just 16 years old. Mays credits him in his early development into becoming one of the greatest players in history. Davis nearly joined Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby, breaking the color barrier in 1947 when he was signed by the St. Louis Browns, but never got to play in the majors. "That was such a shame because he was such a fabulous man," Marshall said. "I would have loved to have seen that." Unquote. Jim Marshall is next asked who his favorite player was to manage, and he replies, quote, "It's tough to separate, but I've got to say Rick Monday is on the top of the list when I manage the Cubs. He was such a great young kid. I was there the day that he grabbed the American flag when those kids were about to burn it. That was the greatest play of his career. I told Rick, 'You owe me money, man. I put you in the lineup so you could do that. Now you have a lifetime job with the Dodgers.' So now he gives me a dollar every time he sees me." Unquote. And his favorite player to watch, quote, "Hank Aaron. Oh my goodness. I couldn't believe that wrist action. Those are the days that you got knocked down quite a bit, I'm telling you. But he would get right back up and hit. He was quiet about it, too. I never saw him get emotional. He was one special player. I did remember outdoing him in something. I played in Memphis, and they had a sign for steamed laundry. If you hit that sign, you get $1,100. I was really proud of that. Some guy came up to me and said, 'Did you know that Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews just missed it?' Well, I got it, and that was one of my biggest thrills in baseball." Unquote. Jim Marshall was part of the first interleague trade in baseball history when the Cubs traded him along with pitcher Dave Hillman to the Boston Red Sox for first baseman Dick Genert on November 21, 1959. Quote, "I never played a game for them. They didn't want left-handed pull hitters. They wanted right-handed hitters. So they traded me in spring training to Cleveland. I go down there, put on my uniform, and I'm really happy. Then I was traded along with Sammy White, a great catcher, for Russ Nixon. Well, 9 days later, White decides to retire. Now the trade is over, and I've got to go back to the Red Sox, and I know that they don't want me. So the general manager comes over and tells me, 'Jim, my wife is swimming over in the apartment right beyond right field. Go spend the day with her, and by the end of the day, I'll find a team for you.' And at the end of the day, I went to the San Francisco Giants. You know something? I got a nice letter from him later on apologizing. That was so nice of him. Unquote. Marshall was next asked about his favorite ballpark. Quote, it had to be Wrigley Field, and that's when they still had people sitting in center field with white shirts. It was tough to see. But my very first game there as a Cub, in August of 1958, I hit 3 home runs in one day. I hit 2 in the first game of the doubleheader against the Phillies, and they were forced to put me into the second game, and I homered again. I couldn't believe it. Unfortunately, I only hit 2 more homers the rest of the season. I still remember sitting on the bench in Chicago. We're playing the Giants, and there's a young guy sitting next to me on the bench. They called on him to go pinch hit, and he struck out on 3 pitches. He came back and sat back down next to me, and I said, "Don't worry, kid. Things are going to get better." It was Billy Williams. So yeah, things got a lot better for him. And then there was Ernie Banks, another great teammate. We had been beating this team pretty good, and well, they somehow found out that we were stealing signs. The next day, they decided that Banks would be the target. They brushed back a few guys, but when they got to Banks, they hit him right in the middle of the back, down by his spine. He could hardly move the next day. He's not out there in the field for batting practice, and could barely walk up the flight of stairs up to the clubhouse. I don't think he's even playing. Well, the game starts, he's in the lineup, and he hits a grand slam. He went around the bases without saying a word. Yes, sir, did I ever admire him. Unquote. Marshall was next asked what the best gesture by a teammate was. Quote, I went to the Chicago White Sox when Larry Doby, the first black player in American League history, was there. I walked into the clubhouse, and the first thing he said was, Jim, anything in my locker you could have. My bat, glove, take whatever you want, okay? He couldn't have been nicer. We played catch a few times together. He was a great player and an awfully nice man. Unquote. Marshall next reflected on the famous batting race. It was the final day of the 1976 season, and Cubs infielder Bill Madlock was trailing Ken Griffey Sr. in the batting race, hitting 338 to 333. While Griffey was kept out of the lineup to help preserve his batting title, Madlock promptly went 4-for-4, increasing his batting average to 339. Quote, I got a call from upstairs, and they said to not let Madlock hit. Take him out now. And I said, man, he's 4-for-4. But they explained that he just went ahead of Griffey in the batting race. So I went to Madlock to tell him, and he asked why. I told him, just do me a favor and walk to the clubhouse. He went down there, and Sparky hurried Griffey back into the game, and he struck out twice and ended up short with a 336 average. I've got to say, it was the first time in my life that I took a guy out of a game who was going 4-for-4 for the day. Unquote. Jim Marshall next reflects on his favorite Vin Scully memory. Quote, I remember walking out of the stadium one day with Vin Scully, and Vinny says, I'm going to move. And I say, Vinny, you've got a nice home. Why are you going to move? And he said, my neighbor keeps throwing trash over my fence. And I said, well, why the hell don't you tell him? And he says, well, it's Sylvester Stallone. Come on, what can I do? Unquote. And Jim Marshall next reflects on his favorite Jackie Robinson tribute. Quote, I got to become good friends with Don Newcomb, and he played a year for the Chunichi Dragons too. So I said one day, Nuke, tell me about Jackie Robinson. I saw Jackie play football at UCLA. Nuke goes, well, I'll tell you something, Jim. he's not much fun to be with. He is such a fierce competitor that you can't have fun doing anything with him. He's out to beat your expletive in golf or whatever else you want to do. It wasn't a knock on Jackie. That's just the way he was, unquote. And finally, there's Jim Marshall's ring collection. Marshall was wearing his 2001 Diamondbacks World Series ring on his left hand and the 2023 National League pennant ring on his right hand at lunch, and he also has a Chunichi Dragons championship ring and a AAA Denver Bears championship ring at home, as well as a ring honoring him from the Professional Baseball Scouts Foundation. So, which one's his favorite? My wedding ring, he said. Bev was everything to me. I met her in junior high school at Roosevelt in Compton. We met because we were listening together to the 1946 World Series on the radio between the Red Sox and the Cardinals during class. She was from Missouri and was a Cardinals fan. We got married when I was 19 and were married for 64 years. I give all of the credit for everything to her. She's been gone for 9 years, and I cannot tell you how much I miss her every day. Unquote. And again, that baseball features entitled Oldest Living Met Looks Back at 70 Years in Baseball, written by Bob Nightingale of USA Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.